Israel is changing the skyline of the Gaza Strip.
Well, Gaza is, of course, under siege.
Non-stop attacks and bombardment of the Strip.
Some have called it an open-air prison.
Israel has dropped white phosphorus on civilians.
Human rights groups have accused Israeli forces of using the chemical white phosphorus in Gaza and Lebanon.
International law is clear that the use of white phosphorus is prohibited in areas with concentrations of civilians. This weapon was being used. Amnesty and other human rights groups have found to reach the level of war crimes.
Allowing such weapon to be used in urban areas exposes Israel to very strong accusations of war crimes.
It's very clear there's no way you can use airburst white phosphorus in a place like Gaza without having indiscriminate effects on civilians.
There clearly are systematic war crimes. White phosphorus is the least of it. You know, there are much more serious things going on in Gaza than white phosphorus.
And the staggering death toll, I think, that demonstrates really the total disregard Israel has and the way that Israel views Palestinian lives as disposable.
Ultimately, when you target hospitals, when you target medical workers, when you target those who are protected under international law, then if you target them militarily, then you have to provide justification for doing that.
The level of destruction is so massive that no one can claim that this is self-defense. This is an extermination campaign, and it's shocking that international community doesn't come to senses and stop this.
Yeah, once I understood what I was part of, what I did, and what's going on, I could not remain silent anymore. The story here is preventing Palestine.
On 7th of October, after the horrific Hamas attack on Israel, Israel retaliated by bombing Gaza, committing many atrocities that Amnesty and other human rights groups have found to reach the level of war crimes. This is because some of them were indiscriminate, meaning that the Israeli military is not adequately distinguishing between military targets and military objectives on the one hand, and civilian targets and civilian objectives on the other hand. And we see that through the astronomical casualty rates in Gaza. In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah and other militants or other armed groups also joined the battle and started firing at military targets in Israel, and Israel also started firing into Lebanon. We've done several investigations about the unlawfulness of some Israeli attacks, including the use of white phosphorus and Haida on October 16, and we've called for both of those incidents to be investigated as war crimes.
My name is Kenneth Roth, and for nearly three decades, I was the executive director of Human Rights Watch. I left about 15 months ago, and I'm currently a visiting professor at Princeton's School of Public and International Affairs. As we see, Israel is using white phosphorus on occasion in Gaza, in southern Lebanon. It has to have a very special reason for doing that. You know, is there an urgent need to light up an area? Is there an urgent need to create a smoke screen that couldn't be created in some other way? We have to do the analysis. But it's difficult to understand why in these heavily populated areas, Israel would ever resort to such a broadly condemned weapon as white phosphorus.
We have a team based in the occupied Palestinian territories. What we were able to do in Gaza is find photographs and videos that people had filmed of the white phosphorus being used. It has a very distinctive way that it spreads in the air, and those are the kinds of videos and images that we verified. There are two ways that we use information and use it to form our cases. So one is interviews with officials and affected residents, and the other is collecting video and photographic evidence and verifying and analyzing those. For attacks that we looked into, we first gathered the photographic and video evidence of the use of white phosphorus, as well as the impacts of the white phosphorus on civilian infrastructure and civilians. We sent those to our digital, to our evidence lab team, who then verified those videos. So what that means is that they are able to geolocate videos and the pictures, and they're able to confirm their authenticity as well as the time that they were taken to confirm that, you know, these attacks did happen on this day in this particular location. We also looked at photographs taken on the Israeli side of the border showing Israeli tanks as well as 155 millimeter white phosphorus rounds. We were able to identify them as white phosphorus rounds due to the nomenclature on the tank rounds that were visible. And therefore, that was kind of another step of verification that yes, on the Israeli side of the border, there were white phosphorus munitions. Throughout most of our investigation, we do rely very heavily on evidence that's collected by journalists. In the case of the investigation into white phosphorus, for example, we did rely on photographs and videos that were taken by photographers from various different agencies, including Anadolu Agency, to show white phosphorus munition rounds on the Israeli side of the border close to Gaza. White phosphorus is a very dangerous substance when it comes into contact with humans. It can cause respiratory damage, organ failure, and very, very severe burns that can't be treated with water.
White phosphorus is extraordinarily dangerous because if it lands on the human skin, it burns and burns and burns. It is very difficult to treat. And so it leaves horrendous injuries. And that's why it is strongly disfavored.
As a soldier, you're actually trained. It's called gash gash chala. You basically need to, if you have an organ that was infected, you need to carve the infected part out in order to stop it from continuing into your body and into that organ. Yeah, because that's the only way to stop it. Or choke it from oxygen. Yeah, but like that's not something you can do in the field. So you basically need to carve it out, the infected part, in order for it not to continue. It's a horrible weapon.
To use it in populated areas has this danger of not only, you know, potentially harming civilians, but harming them in an awful, painful way. And so there is a strong pressure on governments not to use white phosphorus in populated areas.
So Amnesty International and other rights groups have previously documented the Israeli military's use of white phosphorus, particularly in Gaza in 2009. And they used it very often. There was an international outrage against the use of white phosphorus. So there was a case that was brought before the Israeli judiciary. In 2013, the Israeli military committed to restricting the use of white phosphorus. However, as we're seeing from their operations today, they didn't fulfill that pledge or that promise, and they continue to use white phosphorus, sometimes in ways that are unlawful.
My name is Michael Sfat. I'm an Israeli human rights lawyer, and I've also litigated the challenge to the use of weapons with white phosphorus during CAST-led operation in 2008-09 in the Israeli Supreme Court. Well, there is a debate on the question of the legality of white phosphorus. We have an international treaty, the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, that has a protocol that prohibits or restricts the use of incendiary weapons, that is, weapons that are meant to inflame and set fire to the target. White phosphorus can also inflame a lot of time after it is being deployed. So we have evidence from use of white phosphorus in the Gaza Strip in 2008-09 that even after the armed campaign was over and people went back to their homes, children have been suffering from severe wounds because they were exposed to white phosphorus. So white phosphorus meets the criteria of an incendiary weapon that, according to international law, is not to be used in residential areas. However, the definition in the convention for some people has a loophole because it states that incendiary weapons are such weapons that their primary use is to set fire. I would say, as a lawyer that deals with such matters quite a bit, that whether it is an incendiary weapon or not, it is definitely a weapon that is indiscriminate in its nature. That means that when you use white phosphorus and you deploy it over an area, it's not targeted. It is being used in a bomb that opens up in the air, and then dozens of small particles with white phosphorus are landed on a certain area. And by its nature, it does not distinguish between legitimate or lawful and unlawful targets. And so it is indiscriminate by its nature. And that is why our argument in the Israeli Supreme Court was that this is a weapon that is prohibited from being used in an area where you have civilians. Only in open area it is possible to use that weapon.
It's been used by Israel in 2008-2009, and it was deemed illegal by a commission of inquiry which investigated the CAST-led operation.
Well, after the use of white phosphorus in the CAST-led operation Israel has waged in Gaza during 2008-09, I litigated challenge to the legality of the use of white phosphorus in urban areas. I filed a high court petition to the Israeli Supreme Court on behalf of a list of Israeli human rights activists, and we demanded that the army is coerced to issue commands that would prohibit the use of white phosphorus in inhabited areas. In the framework of that litigation, I have asked Forensic Architecture and Sito Studios to provide a spatial analysis of how white phosphorus affects an area where it is deployed.
My name is Bradley Samuels, and I'm a director at C2. We describe C2's work as combining data and design to create new pathways for justice. This typically means that we're working on fact-finding and reporting focused on human rights violations, usually at the intersection of law, technology, and design. So we worked on a report in 2009 focused on the use of white phosphorus munitions in urban environments. Because white phosphorus is often considered an indiscriminate munition, and we wanted to better understand how the weapon was being deployed specifically in urban environments, and to address this question of whether it could be truly targeted with precision, or whether it was in fact indiscriminate. It was a very robust collaboration between C2 and Forensic Architecture. There was a tremendous amount of data to go through, everything from photographs, to videos of white phosphorus being used, to specifications of technical performance.
And in order for the judges to better understand what are the outcomes of the use of white phosphorus in urban areas, I ask them to generate computerized model in which we can show the effect of such bombs being deployed.
Michael framed the legal questions that were really driving this project. So the IDF has sort of claimed in the past, and others, the US military who've used it in Iraq, that white phosphorus is deployed as a smokescreen. So not for its incendiary effects. Their argument is that they deploy it to mask movements of troops and things like this. We wanted to focus on the secondary effects, right? Which were the fact that this does cause fires, it does burn people. And so we focused on what we call an effects-based analysis.
There is a strong presumption against using white phosphorus in any place where there's a significant civilian population, simply because it's so likely to do grievous harm to those civilians. So in each case, you've got to look at what happened. You know, what was the supposed rationale? You know, was it really urgent to illuminate the area? Was it urgent to create a smoke screen? It's hard to imagine what those reasons would be in the middle of Gaza. But these are the questions that you have to ask before concluding that the use of white phosphorus was a war crime.
Yeah, so white phosphorus, when used in warfare, really depends on location, its analysis. It's really not possible to evaluate it based on the munition alone. It's really an evaluation of the munition in relation to the context in which it's deployed. It's an airburst munition, so it's fired from an artillery, and it bursts anywhere between 50 and 200 meters above the ground. It opens, and inside, there's 116 phosphorus-soaked felt wedges, which, as soon as they come into contact with oxygen, begin to burn. And so you can imagine, you know, whether it's 50 meters or 200 meters, they're descending from the sky, 116 of them, and they fall essentially in elliptical pattern, but the size of that ellipse can vary dramatically based on angle of fire, height of burst, and things like this. Anything that happens within the ellipse is indeterminate. The wedges will fall within that area, but you cannot control exactly where. There's no propulsion, there's no guidance, they're just falling based on gravity at that point. And if you're using this in a very densely populated urban environment, you must expect that anywhere within the ellipse will be potentially covered in felt wedges that are burning and cause fires and can do all kinds of damage. Yeah, during Operation Cast Lead, there's a number of examples of the ways in which airburst white phosphorus has caused harm to civilians. So let's say a piece of phosphorus wedge falls on the ground, it might be there for days, it might burn out, but then a child might find it a few days later, flip it over, and it will start burning again and can burn right through their flesh and their bone. It also ricochets, so it may land in one area, bounce, and sort of go somewhere else. But I think, you know, the biggest danger to civilians is the way it causes fires in places where civilians can be trapped. So it often lands on roofs or balconies, or it can go through windows. And there's an example of a school in Gaza where some of the white phosphorus wedges penetrated the window, and it started a fire within a space in which students were trapped and died.
But also medical crews who have been treating people with injuries from white phosphorus, they themselves have been injured by the white phosphorus because it continues to burn. That's the monstrosity of that substance. It continues to burn. It touches your skin. It burns the skin. It enters your internal organs and continues to burn. And that is a really horrific kind of weapon that humanity has created. Well, the finding showed how horrendous the deployment of bombs with white phosphorus can be in an urban area, what kind of effect it had, how many dozens of civilian objects have been set in fire because of the white phosphorus. Also, the report managed to show what would have been the effect if the same kind of munition would have been deployed in other cities of the world, and how extensive the destruction and the damage such deployment can cause.
One thing that Michael Sfard asked us to do, which I think was very useful, was to simulate its use not only in Gaza, but in Tel Aviv, in Paris, and New York City. Gaza is the most extreme example. It would cause incredible harm in all of those locations. and Gaza worst of all because it is so densely populated. But I think to bring home the understanding of how this weapon does damage, not just in one location, but any urban environment, right? Our own urban environment. So that was an important part of the analysis as well.
In our petition, we demanded that the court force the army to issue orders, binding orders, that would restrict the use of munition that contains white phosphorus so that it will not be allowed to be used at all in areas where you have civilians, in inhabited areas, residential areas, urban areas. That was our request. And according to the description the judges have provided of those orders in the judgment, those orders limit extensively the use munition with white phosphorus in urban areas. And so the court has accepted that those new orders are enough and that they adhere to international law. The problem was that such orders can always be changed. So I don't know what happened in the last 12 years since the judgment was given and whether those orders have been indeed changed.
Submission of this work to the High Court in Israel was about regulating its future use and not determining culpability for past use. I mean, it's very obvious and very clear that white phosphorus was used in Operation Cast Lead. That's not debatable. It's very easy to see. As we've seen, white phosphorus has been used again this past year in 2023. The problems remain exactly the same. Should not be used. It should be clearly condemned and banned. Over 10 years ago that we did this work, and in some way the work has an absurd quality to it because we're demonstrating something that's obvious. But I think it's important work because without quantifying the effects of this munition, without documenting it thoroughly, and without closing legal loopholes for the use of indiscriminate weapons, it allows states in positions of power to continue to use them with impunity. And so I'm eager and keen to see if that impunity can be closed down and more regard can be brought to civilian life.
No, I think our litigation was very successful in bringing to the attention of the military lawyers that allowing such weapon to be used in urban areas exposes Israel to very strong accusations of war crimes.
There are two questions that really arise from the use of white phosphorus in particular. Is one, whether it constitutes a war crime by the use of it, because it is very difficult to control. And secondly, those who are providing Israel with such material, whether they can be prosecuted, entities within those states can be prosecuted for providing weapons where they know it's going to be used for the commission of war crimes.
So what we are trying to do is push for accountability. Our position has been there should be an arms embargo in Israel, given the very high likelihood that U.S. supplied weapons to Israel are being used to commit war crimes and other violations of international law.
The fact that white phosphorus was used before, criticized, internationally condemned, including by a commission of inquiry, of an independent commission of inquiry appointed by the United Nations, and then used again, is to be understood in a framework of tolerated impunity. Israel has been granted impunity for decades.
The use of white phosphorus in 2009, at that moment, the International Criminal Court did not have jurisdiction. So that doesn't tell us anything about what the International Criminal Court will do today, where it does have jurisdiction. So that's, you know, one big difference between prior uses and this one. The fact that Israel may have said, oh, you know, back in 2009, we won't use it again. You know, the Israeli government also ratified these treaties saying that they wouldn't bomb civilians, and they ignored those treaties. So, you know, I'm not sure how much the Israeli government's word matters here. We have to judge what it did. There clearly are systematic war crimes. White phosphorus is the least of it. You know, there are much more serious things going on in Gaza than white phosphorus.
My name is Toby Cadden. I'm a barrister. the rules of international humanitarian law are strict for a reason. And any state that signs up to a treaty is bound by its contents. So, for example, if we look at the Genocide Convention as an example, there is an obligation to respect the terms of that treaty, but there is also an obligation on states to prevent a genocide.
One important thing to know about international humanitarian law is that war crimes by one side do not justify war crimes by the other. So even if we accept that what Hamas did on October 7th was horrible, these are war crimes, they violate the basic provisions of humanitarian law, that does not justify Israel ignoring international humanitarian law.
My name is Francesca Albanese, and I am the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the Palestinian territory occupied by Israel since 1967. While Israel has the right to protect itself, protect its territory and its citizens, the response was to be given within the limits of international humanitarian law. And the attack instead, the assault, has been absolutely violent, indiscriminate. It seems to me that the target was, as many soldiers on the ground say, to destroy, displace, and settle. And it's becoming clearer and clearer.
And there are several respects in which the Israeli attacks in Gaza violate humanitarian law. First, in some cases, they actually are targeting civilian targets where it's hard to understand what's the military purpose. They bombed Islamic University of Gaza. It has been bombing, you know, big apartment buildings, prestige addresses, not because there's a Hamas presence there of any significance, but just to sort of show that there'd be consequences on civilians and to sort of force civilians to stand up to Hamas.
Between 60 and 70% of Gaza's civilian infrastructure has been either destroyed or severely damaged. There's been the bombing of schools, mosques, bakeries, electricity, the electricity system, the sewage system.
So even the basic provision that you don't target civilians and civilian structures has been violated. More generally, Israel has been firing indiscriminately into certain civilian populated areas. So just to give an example, the Jabalia refugee camp. Israel says there were Hamas tunnels underneath, that it was a Hamas command headquarters of sorts. Let's accept that that's true. But Israel chose to drop 2,000-pound bombs in the middle of a heavily populated refugee camp.
In the case of the refugee camp that was hit, where they believed that there was one Hamas leader there, and then that results in several hundred civilian deaths, it is very difficult to justify that as military necessity.
So this kind of, you know, use of extremely heavy weaponry, high explosives, in the middle of many civilians, that defines an indiscriminate attack.
Even the Washington Post and then the New York Times a few weeks ago declared that Israel has been using at least 200 times 2,000-pound bombs are equivalent to the use of over 2 nuclear bombs over such a small piece of land of 365 square kilometers. Of course, this is destructive.
What we're seeing definitely raises the suspicion that Israel has engaged in indiscriminate attacks of civilian and residential areas in Gaza.
And we see time and time again that they are going after targets knowing that many civilians will be killed. So they will attack a house because there's maybe a Hamas fighter who lives there without regard to his family. They will, you know, attack major buildings because of an ostensible Hamas presence without regard to the civilians.
They know what they're doing, and they seem to be unstoppable.
One fundamental provision of international humanitarian law is that healthcare workers and healthcare facilities are protected. Now, that protection can be lost if the opposing military uses these facilities for military purposes, but there's a strong presumption against attacking them. Now, in the case of Gaza, the World Health Organization has outlined numerous cases in which Israeli forces have attacked healthcare officials, ambulances, hospitals, and the like. In some cases, Israel says, oh, Hamas was using these. But when you look at the overall effect,
quite often the argument which is used is that you have militants hiding amongst medical personnel. And we've seen some of the medical personnel being interviewed. Effectively, there's no basis for concluding that Hamas is hiding in hospitals and using the cover of the Red Cross or Red Crescent.
It is a horrific night in Gaza, where an airstrike hit a hospital, killing hundreds.
An Israeli airstrike on a hospital in central Gaza.
Hundreds of people were killed at a Gaza city hospital.
Israeli airstrike hit a hospital in Gaza a short time ago, with fears that hundreds are dead.
And there's no allegation that Hamas was firing from the hospitals, just these, you know, unproven allegations of a headquarters that has not been demonstrated. And all we've seen so far is, frankly, a minimal Hamas presence that does not justify this shutting down of a good part of the civilian medical system in Gaza.
Ultimately, when you target hospitals, when you target medical workers, when you target those who are protected under international law, then if you target them militarily, then you have to provide justification for doing that.
Israeli tank shell struck a group of journalists in southern Lebanon on October 13.
Now, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have released findings on the Israeli attack on journalists in Lebanon. Reuters journalist Issam Abdallah was killed and six others were injured during the attack.
There are many important civilian officials, civilian institutions that have been hit by the Israeli bombardment. And in most cases, it's difficult to know, were they precisely targeted, or is this just a product of indiscriminate warfare? There's one case that Human Rights Watch was able to look into, actually in southern Lebanon, not in Gaza, where it was quite clear that Israeli forces deliberately targeted a group of journalists who were well-marked. They were away from any fighting. They killed one Reuters journalist and injured six.
We have investigated the October 13 attack on a group of journalists in South Lebanon that resulted in the killing of Issam Abdallah from Reuters, as well as the injury of six other journalists from Reuters, AFP, and Al Jazeera. We spent about 2 months investigating that particular attack. We analyzed over 100 photos and videos that were captured by the journalists on the scene, as well as by journalists who were nearby. So all of this led us to the conclusion that the Israeli military either knew or should have known that the group of individuals were civilians, not a military target.
In terms of the killing of journalists, the Committee to Protect Journalists has reported that nearly 70 journalists have been killed since the beginning of the conflict. Journalists must never, ever be a target for military action. They are there to report on what's happening. They are our eyes and ears, and they're there to bear witness to crimes that are being committed by all sides.
In the last few minutes also, we've had the Israeli Defense Minister coming out and saying that he is ordering a siege on Gaza.
As Israel enforces a complete siege.
With Israel's military having ordered a total siege on Gaza.
One of the clearest war crimes that the Israeli military is committing is the siege that it is imposing on Palestinian civilians in Gaza. This is so clear that even the International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan, who has been very reluctant to get involved, even he warned Israel that if you maintain the siege, don't be surprised if my office issues war crime charges.
In this regard, I have to say that Israel has clear obligations in relation to its war with Hamas. Not just moral obligations, but legal obligations to comply with the laws of armed conflict.
So when we look at the blockade now, and we look at the conditions that the people of Gaza have been subjected to, some of them amounting to to a withholding of basic necessities, water, electricity, food. We also have to look at forced starvation as a war crime, and it's something that obviously the ICC would have jurisdiction to consider.
So it is serious. Now, the humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, say that even in the middle of a war, you have a duty to allow civilians in need access to humanitarian aid. The United Nations has plenty of aid. It's been sitting there in Egypt, just across the border, ready to come in. And the Israeli government has been allowing it in, sometimes not at all, sometimes only in drips and drabs. And this comes on top of a 16-year blockade.
Not being allowed to leave the territory. They're essentially trapped in Gaza.
And so creating a population in Gaza that is dependent on humanitarian aid. And since October 7th, much of that has been shut off.
People are suffering a great deal under bombardment. They are not eating, they are not sleeping, they are in constant fear, they are running from place to place to seek safety. But of course, there is no place safe in Gaza. There is nowhere for them to go.
And so this is a clear violation of humanitarian law. And the bits and pieces that are allowed in right now in no sense replicate the 500 trucks a day of commercial and humanitarian aid that were coming into Gaza before October 7th. The drips and drabs that Israel allows in no sense replicates the basic needs that the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza has, and those needs remain unmet. One thing that worries me and many others is that the Israeli government may be discounting the value of Palestinian civilian life because of signals from the top. The most senior leaders are giving the opposite signal. The defense minister says these are all human animals.
אנחנו מטילים מצור מוחלט על העיר עזה. אין חשמל, אין מזון, אין מים, אין דלק. הכל סגור. אנחנו נלחמים בחיות אדם.
Netanyahu says, citing a biblical verse, he suggests it's okay to kill men, women, children, and all animals.
אנחנו בני האור, הם בני החושך, והאור ינצח את החושך.
This kind of signal from the top is an invitation to war crimes.
חלק מתיקון הטעות מההכרה בחטא הקונספציה שהביא עלינו השביל העשירי, זה לחזור הביתה לגוש קטיף ולצפון השומרון.
ערב טוב. אנחנו מיישבים את ארצנו לאורכה ולרוחבה, שולטים בה, נלחמים בטרור תמיד, ומביאים בעזרת השם ביטחון לכל מדינת ישראל. אתם יודעים מה התשובה. בלי התיישבות אין ביטחון.
When we see the kind of language which is being used by leading Israeli politicians to flatter Gaza, to remove all Palestinians and to say that there are no civilians in Gaza because they voted for Hamas, so they've effectively sided with a terrorist organization. That's the kind of language which is being used. And then you hear the language being used as to what the Israeli administration's intentions are when the conflict ends, and it will end at some point. Their intention is to govern Gaza, is to expand settlements into Gaza.
I'm personally shocked by how overt the genocidal intent has been across various messages passed and various arguments made by Israeli political leaders, military leaders, and then now resonates and gets amplified across various segments of the society who are calling for leveling Gaza, flattening Gaza, erasing Gaza, and pushing the population out of Gaza.
My name is Yehuda Shaul, born and raised in Jerusalem.
I graduated high school, I joined the IDF. In Israel, we have a draft. In my time, it was 3 years for men, so I served 3 years in the military. I cannot unknow what I know. I cannot undo what I did. But I can dedicate the rest of my life to try to bring the occupation to an end. It's about ending a reality where millions of Palestinians are systematically discriminated with our rights and dignity. One of the things we used to do a lot in the military was what we call in the IDF to make our presence felt. You bump into a house, it's not a house we had intelligence about. Yeah, it's a random house. Bump into the house, wake up the family, search the place. You can yourself imagine the dynamics, what happens when a military unit enters your house 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, finish searching, go out to the street, make some noise, knock on some doors, throw some shock grenades, run to the other corner of the street, invade another random house, wake up the next family. And that's basically how you spend your 8-hour shift. Basically intimidation. The only way to rule people against their will without giving them rights forever is by making them fear you. And once they get used to a level of fear, you have to increase it and increase it. That is the orders. Yeah, that's the mission statement. That's why these patrols exist until today. One of the first things that opened my mind, my eyes, that brought me to ask questions during my service was the fact that settlers were attacking Palestinians, in many cases right in front of us. Our orders were not to intervene. Our mission as soldiers there was to protect the settlers. And if we see settlers attacking Palestinians, not our job. Basically, the reality is that you have in the same territory, in the same area, you have two populations, two communities, Israeli settlers and Palestinians. They live under two different legal systems, enforced by two different executive branches. So you have the army enforcing martial law on Palestinians, and you have the Israeli civilian police supposed to enforce Israeli civilian law on settlers. Let's say I'm an Israeli, you're a Palestinian, and let's assume we both throw stones at each other, and let's assume for the sake of this demonstration is we both get arrested. As an Israeli throwing stones, I committed a criminal offense. As a Palestinian throwing stones, you committed a security offense, a terrorist offense. If they want to keep me in custody, they need to bring me in front of a judge within 24 hours. I can demand to speak to a lawyer right away before my first interrogation. You we can keep for a few days without a lawyer. You we can keep for a few days before we bring you in front of a judge. Fundamentally, the discrimination is built in the system. What I'm trying to say is that the lack of law enforcement is not a bug in the system, it's a feature of the system. It's the structure, the way it's designed. The Israeli occupation is an ongoing offensive campaign against Palestinian independence that didn't stop for 1 second from June 67. Millions of offensive actions that are taking place all the time everywhere in the occupied territories. Every new house you build in a settlement, you reoccupy the territories. Every house you bump into in the middle of the night to create a sense of being chased inside the Palestinian population, to make your presence felt, you reoccupy the territories. Every random checkpoint you put on a highway to disrupt the day-to-day routine of people in the area, you reoccupy the territories. Everything we do is an offensive act to entrench our rule and prevent Palestinian independence. The story here is preventing Palestine.
Well, certainly I've mentioned the current apartheid more than once, and one of the foundations for that is the Human Rights Watch report. So this was one of the first and well-documented, well-researched reports that looked at all aspects of the treatment of Palestinians as compared to the treatment of Israeli Jews.
Human Rights Watch issued a report finding the Israeli government to be committing the crime of apartheid. And so we conducted a very detailed factual investigation. And we did not make an analogy to South Africa. This is not an historical report. This is a legal report. We applied two treaties, the UN Convention Against Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, both of which define apartheid. And they require an intent by one racial or ethnic group to dominate another. And we found that to exist actually in both Israel proper and the occupied territory. And it requires systematic oppression and examples of that oppression in the form of inhumane acts. And we found that that oppression and those inhumane acts had taken place within the occupied territory. And so we concluded that there is apartheid in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And we did this in a 200-plus page report filled with details. What was interesting is the Israeli government didn't know what to do with that. They couldn't find anything factually or legally wrong. Their supporters tried the usual name-calling, you know, you're biased, you're anti-Semitic, but they had nothing to say because it was accurate.
As I look at the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, of course it's apartheid.
Now, October 7th has only accelerated that pressure because it has shown that this endless oppression, this endless occupation, this apartheid is not tolerable for Palestinians living under it. Israel has enjoyed many, many years of impunity for the way it treats Palestinian civilians. Israeli courts don't oversee the prosecution for the most part of Israeli soldiers. It's extremely rare when that happens. There's been no international pressure. And so for the most part, Israeli war crimes have happened without criminal consequences.
The one thing that we see quite often with Israel is they'll completely disregard what anyone outside of Israel says. They'll disregard the United Nations, they'll disregard the International Criminal Court.
Now it could be different because the International Criminal Court today does have jurisdiction over anything that Israel does in Gaza.
So, of course, the ultimate end is accountability. We're also calling for the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction over the Palestinian territories, to also investigate those attacks.
Obviously, the International Criminal Court is already investigating suspicions of Israeli violations of international laws of war. But it seems that for the ICC to target Israel is a very, very risky drill because of Israel's political might.
The scale and the level of impunity that Israel has enjoyed over the past few decades is really at the heart of the human rights crisis that we see in Israel and Palestine. And that cannot be allowed to continue.
I think what happens in the International Criminal Court is incredibly important, but it is just one part of a much broader picture of what we need to be thinking of. We also have the International Court of Justice, just across the road from the International Criminal Court, that has jurisdiction to deal with state responsibilities.
Well, the world is awaiting a decision by the International Court of Justice on whether or not Israel has indeed committed acts of genocide in Gaza.
That South Africa considers Israel to be responsible for committing genocide in Gaza and for failing to prevent and punish genocidal acts.
I'm glad South Africa had the moral courage, the lucidity to take the case to the ICJ, because this is now necessary. Someone needs to make a ceasefire binding and compulsory. We are facing such a massive, toxic mix of criminal conducts. I cannot think of one rule of international humanitarian law which has not been violated.
As an American Jew, it's very concerning, specifically in regard to the lack of focus on civilian life and civilian casualties.
This is part of a cycle of violence that will continue to repeat unless the root causes are addressed, which means dismantling Israel's system of apartheid. It means ending the blockade on Gaza, and it means ensuring accountability for crimes committed by Israel.
The question that we have to ask, if we do nothing now, as we've done nothing for the last few decades as far as Palestine is concerned, but if we do nothing now, if we don't hold those who are responsible, if we don't hold them accountable through a judicial process, we have to ask ourselves, what is the next conflict going to look like?
If we will keep permanent military rule over Gaza after this war, if a year or two or three will pass by with IDF presence throughout the Gaza Strip, the danger of resettling Gaza is going to grow exponentially.
For me, the collapse of the value system of justice, human rights, freedom, and equality that we have built in the aftermath of the Second World War, and the betrayal of the never again, that we promised ourselves as a collective, as a world society, as the people of the world after the Holocaust. We are not able to honor that promise.